Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. Adam Boileau is back in the co-host's chair this week. He'll be joining us in just a little bit to talk through all the week's security news. And then we have a new sponsor in this week's show, ExtraHop Networks. Network monitoring is dead. Long live network monitoring. ExtraHop do network detection stuff, but their gear isn't really just about security. It does all sorts of stuff. Performance monitoring and network health monitoring, and I guess, yeah, infrastructure health and performance can be inferred from network monitoring if you go deep enough with it, and they do. Matt Cawthorne is ExtraHop's VP of Cybersecurity Engineering, and he'll join us this week to talk about recent moves by cloud providers to offer full sort of network mirror ports, like out of their infrastructure. So you can get like virtual network taps out of your cloud infrastructure. ExtraHop, no surprises here. They're pretty thrilled about that because, hey, more network data for the network data gods. That chat is coming up after the week's news with Adam Boileau, which starts now. And mate, it's interesting. NSA's new cybersecurity directorate pulling a leaf out of the security marketing playbook from 2002 by dropping some sweet, sweet bugs.
Yeah, there was quite the hype train in progress. Everyone was getting rather excited on the InfoSec Twitters. All aboard.
Yep.
Getting quite excited about, you know, a bug coming down the line. We saw some early suggestions that it was going to be in a cryptographic subsystem in Windows. And sure enough, that's what it turned out to be. We've got a bug in the certificate validation portion of Microsoft's platform cryptography library that's used by, you know, all sorts of Windows software, you know, browsers, system plumbing, pretty much every piece of software that uses the normal standard way of doing TLS on the platform, or using, you know, PKI in general on the platform. And yeah, it's it's not a bad bug. It's not quite the bug I was hoping for, of course.
I was hoping for memory corruption in certificate validation or something.
Yeah, but I wanted the Uber bug. But it's a really interesting bug. I mean, the guts of it is that by crafting a certificate with a particular set of parameters for the elliptic curves, when you're using elliptic curve cryptography, you can kind of specify a new parameters or specify a new curve that mean that you can impersonate another site. You can generate a certificate that looks valid to the Windows validation subsystem for something that you don't have the private key for through crafting the elliptic curves just right. Now, what that means big picture, potentially man in the middle, you know, of TLS connections on the wire. We've seen people implementing it, with varying degrees of, you know, fiddle required. But I mean, essentially, yes, you can man in the middle TLS connections and have them be validated. There's conversation of using that to bypass code signing via AuthentiCode or anything else where the trust anchor is via the PKI. I mean, we were talking around the office about whether you could use it for Windows wireless authentication when you've got certificate-based corporate wireless network access. That would be a pretty sweet thing to do. So there's a bunch of places
you can,
where
you can probably drop some. I saw some talk that Google Chrome updates could be affected. You could just, if you can get upstream, you can just send dodgy Chrome updates and Robert's your mother's brother.
Yeah, I mean, I think, the thing that's going to really stick out about this bug is that it's going to be a very, very kind of long tail of places that are impacted by it and ways to leverage it. I mean, obviously, hopefully people are going to patch and that will kill a bunch of it. But, much like we saw those bugs in Zlib, the compression stuff back in, a couple of years ago now, cryptography and PKI is used by so many things in so many different ways, whether it's Windows Update, whether it's Chrome updates, whether it's, network traffic, wireless authentication, code signing, all manner of application whitelisting, relying on digital signatures to figure out which binaries are going to be able to run. I mean, there's just all sorts of ways that it's used. And we don't really know where all of those are going to crop up yet. And then, of course, there's the interaction with all of the other implementations, of PKI parsing. Once you see the bug in one place, then people are obviously going to go and look for similar sorts of things elsewhere. And there have been similar bugs in other TLS libraries and other ciphers, like with DSA, over the years. And the nature of the bug itself, we've seen a bunch of people kind of starting to pull apart and reasoning about what it is. And, some of the analysis that I've read, and I haven't seen, anything that's super concrete, but it does seem to suggest that it's a pretty kind of basic for elliptic curve cryptography, a pretty basic kind of bug, which I'm kind of surprised by. I saw some comments by our local cryptographer, Peter Goodman, saying that, you know, basically the standards say you should not be doing this in the first place. Like, this is a must not, according to the standards, in terms of allowing curves with their own parameters. And I'm not, you know, that's a little too deep in the crypto weeds for me. I'd rather figure out how to shell people with it. But, I mean, it didn't seem like a super competent, you know, like, yeah, a bug that's really, really nuanced. It seemed pretty like you should have got this right sort of thing, but I mean, maybe I'm being unfair there.
Well, I mean, you can totally see why NSA would think this is a big deal, because, I mean, if you're dealing with a sophisticated adversary, quote unquote sophisticated adversary, this is the sort of stuff that they're going to be in a good position to use, you know, when they're doing BGP route hijacks or getting upstream and just being generally sneaky. This is the sort of stuff that if you're NSA, you're going to be worried about more than others. And particularly because it doesn't necessitate things to be, you know, accessible from the internet, right? If you can get upstream DNS, it's pretty much game over.
Yeah, I mean, a group like NSA is very much in a position to make a lot of hay out of a bug like this. And we've seen them use bugs with similar primitives. I mean,
well, the Flame malware one, right?
The Flame sign, you know, hash collision updates thing. Like, this is the sort of bug that they would use for that in the old days, I guess, instead of epping it. Or maybe they have been, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, they're in it with like the quantum insert and quantum intercept kind of thing, where they can get in the middle of transactions on the network. Like, this is the sort of thing that you're going to want. And there may well be, you know, as you say, like, you can use it in private environments, you can use it against corporate certificates. There's just lots of ways to utilize it. And yeah, it's the sort of bug, like actual guts crypto, that you would expect, you know, a spook agency with such a strong history in cryptography to be using. And yeah, the fact that they've dropped it and put their name on it, I mean, part of that is PR. I mean, they do.
Yeah, there's a bit of marketing, because it's the cybersecurity directorate is pretty new. So this is a way of saying we have arrived. But, you know, a lot of commentary has said, oh, well, they've never disclosed bugs via VEP before. Well, how do you know that, right? There's plenty of uncredited stuff in Microsoft advisories and heaps. Plenty of stuff that goes in through third parties and whatever. So I think it's just different because they're putting their name on it. And, you know, they organized a press conference and this and that. And I don't know. I mean, I think the backlash to this has been kind of a little overdone, like people poo-pooing the bug because it was hyped. And I'm just thinking, no. I mean, I can totally see from an NSA perspective why this one is a huge deal, given the type of adversaries they tend to come up against. And also, you know, they probably use similar stuff in anger in the past and they know how far it gets you, right? So I think it would pay to listen to them and get on this one pronto, personally.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's no arguing that it is a big deal bug, and we haven't really seen one like this in the Windows TLS subsystem, you know, in the PKI, you know, for a while. We've seen OpenSSL and some of the other open source ones have, you know, sort of issues with cert parsing over the years and cert validation, but we haven't really seen one like this. And it is, you know, everything relies on PKI, and we use it to solve, you know, just myriad of problems. And when it doesn't work, then things really, really go wrong. On the other hand, you know, when I look at the Patch Tuesday list for this month, you know, it's not the bug that I'm excited about.
Yeah, right?
It's a bunch of other ones that are way
good
more
ones in there, right?
For me doing hacking in the way that I do it, right, and obviously, you know, I approach it a little differently in the NSA because I don't have, you know, pervasive global upstream capability or whatever else, you know, I'm more excited about some of the other bugs. And in terms of the things I would rather see people focus on fixing immediately, I mean, you could kind of deal with this one at the gateway if you can intercept, or you can look at certs as they go past. You could kind of deal with this one more passively than having to patch everything. On the other hand, you really ought to be able to patch your Windows 10 boxes or your Windows Server 2016 on Patch Tuesday. Like, that ought to be a capability that you have.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that monitor for this is realistic advice for most organizations, frankly. I mean, there's some that can do it, but yeah, better just to fix it.
I mean, yeah, the organizations who could monitor for this probably already have their patching sorted, and yeah, people who can't patch probably don't have the necessary visibility into the network and maturity to be able to monitor and respond. So, you know, you're right. And being able to apply patches from your vendor, like, there's a reason that's what number one on the ASD's, you know, list of things you really ought to be able to do is patch your dumb OS and patch your dumb application, and then, you know, worry about other things like application whitelisting, which, hey, relies on the PKI, so better patch that. Yeah, I mean, there's a reason patching is so far up the list, and you ought to be able to do it, and you shouldn't have to worry too much about, you know, having to, you know, dig really into the details of some of these bugs. That's kind of, you know, the problem of us poor hackers who want to shell people with them.
And it's funny, right, because Windows Update itself is not affected by this as best I can tell, because I think for a few reasons there's cert pinning involved, and also, like, they sign it, like, a few different ways. And I think they learned their lesson from the whole Flame thing when NSA did get around their code signing to drop malware on various targets. And yeah, you can't do that anymore, unfortunately, for some. Windows 7, meanwhile, we've hit sort of EOL, end of support for Windows 7. And as you mentioned, there were a couple of other bugs in there. There was one in like RDP Gateway or something. Like, what's that one about?
Yeah, so there's a pretty good swathe of bugs. There's a couple in the Microsoft RDP Gateway, which is like pre-auth remote code exec against a thing that's meant to be a perimeter security service. So that's pretty bad.
There's a bit of that going around at the moment. We'll get to that
anyway. Yeah, exactly right. That's the new hotness is, you know, security edge devices like that. So yeah, there's a couple of RDP bugs.
The new hotness looks an awful lot like the old hotness, but anyway.
Maybe it's just hotness. I don't know. Yeah. So yeah, RDP bugs against RDP Gateway. There's also an RDP client bug going back another direction, which looks interesting. I haven't dug into that much. There's a kind of mysterious .NET bug that says Microsoft says can lead to arbitrary code execution, but then doesn't provide any details for you to judge whether or not it's, you know, like every .NET web application is remotely rootable, or whether, you know, if you provide attacker-supplied input to a system call, then, you know, they can exec code and it means nothing. So it's hard to tell because there's so little information in the Microsoft advisories of late that I don't even know, but there's a bunch of good bugs. There's the usual selection of IE things and whatever else, but those RDP gateway ones, that's got to be, you know, everybody who's been sitting smugly because they don't have Citrix, which we'll get to in a second, you probably ought to patch their RDSs and stuff.
Now, look, on that, on the Citrix thing, this is funny, right? Because I think last week, you know, I went through all of the news that I missed since I was on leave, and it was from like December 20 or something. There was this story about a Citrix bug. And I just reading this story, I'm like, this looks pretty bad. And even though it was weeks old, like it was the one bug that we spoke about last week. And I was like, yeah, we don't normally talk really a lot about bugs, but I feel like this one might be worth mentioning. And I think within 3 days of last week's show going out, there was proof of concept, right? Publicly available. It is like this trivial, someone calling themselves Project Zero India, like dropped POC on a Friday afternoon, which is just like, that's just mean. But yeah, there's exploits everywhere. There's exploitation in the wild. It turns out like it's like a really dumb path traversal bug, and it's it's just real horror show stuff. And I think a lot more people are going to get owned with this than you know, fancy forged certs.
Yeah, I mean, the bug is interesting for a couple of reasons. Like, one is obviously it's an edge device that's meant to be a security control point, and a lot of people use it and expose it to the internet. So there's a whole bunch of exposure there. But also the bug itself, as you say, is kind of dumb, and the POCs that we've seen and the way it was originally disclosed required kind of two bugs chained together. There's a path traversal and then a way to turn like a templating thing into code execution. That second half is independent, right? You can use that in a bunch of other ways. And, you know, we were rummaging around and there are other ways to do it. For example, post-auth. Sorry, I mean, the path traversal buys you the pre-auth part, but there may well be post-auth things that even when you, so if you're not necessarily worried about it being on the internet, but you do have a user base that, you know, may get compromised or something else, there may be other vectors to hit it. So it's a pretty gnarly bug. And the impact, of course, is super bad. I mean, compromising the Citrix gateway gets you all of the sessions that are running through it, all of the creds, all of the access onwards. It's just like it's a wonderful place to compromise a network, that kind of edge control device. So I really like that bug. And then it's complicated by the fact that Citrix have then dragged their heels in providing patches for it. And it's just turned into a real shit show for everybody running Citrix and Citrix themselves.
Yeah, I still remember, and I did mention it last week, I think it was Brett Moore did that talk on owning Citrix stuff like 10 years ago at KiwiCon, but it was just, it was one of those ones where you're just sitting there like rubbing your temples, just going, you know?
So
remember
good.
When he used like the help loader in Notepad or whatever to get shells, you know, after somehow getting access to applications served through the gateway, like without auth, you know, it was just really, you remember that talk? It was really good hacking.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing Brett would do, yes. He does love a good Citrix shell.
Yes. So there we go. And there's Citrix shells for everyone this week. Now, look, we're going to turn our attention to, you know, what initially looks like a bombshell report from the New York Times, but has since sort of been revealed to be a little bit problematic. The headline screams, Russians hacked Ukrainian gas company at center of impeachment. And the story, in essence, says that GRU operatives registered a bunch of phishing domains belonging to subsidiaries of Burisma, the gas company that's involved in this whole, you know, impeachment scandal in the United States, alleged corruption, and other people saying there's disinformation about corruption and whatever. But yeah, apparently GRU trying to hack into Burisma Holdings, subsidiaries in Ukraine, And so, sure, you know, people had spotted those domains in certificate transparency logs last year. Where this story, in my view at least, gets a little bit shaky is where it starts asserting that this hack was successful, right? Because there's nothing in the story to substantiate this idea that it was successful, right? There is just simply nothing in it to substantiate that. Now, this comes from the same journalist who brought us the bogus reporting on the Baltimore City ransomware attack being tied to Eternal Blue, right? So we have seen similar sort of, I don't know, I hate calling out people like this, but this isn't very good reporting. And in fact, in subsequent reports from like Reuters and others, they do not make that claim. It seems irresponsible in my mind to say that it was successful definitively. Now, could it have been successful? Absolutely. Was it successful? Maybe. But we don't know the extent to which it was successful. We don't have any indication as to how they're basing that claim. Do you know what I mean? Like, and this has turned into a massive story. Initially, when I read it, I tweeted it going, oh my God, this could be the story of the year. And then I read it again and I'm like, hang on, they haven't backed any of this up. How did you go reading this one?
Yeah, I mean, I had much the same reaction, right? I mean, it seems like a really, you know, kind of bombshell sort of story and ties in with a bunch of the narratives that we expect, right? That the Russians are going to stick their oar into the US elections in the same sort of way that they've done in the past. And I certainly don't doubt that the, you know, the GOU and a bunch of the other, you know, crews in Russia are out, you know, doing business on the internet. But you do wonder then, how the groups that are attributing this are doing so. So there's a bunch of tells in terms of the phishing campaigns and the way infrastructure set up that points to.
Yeah, a few people have come out and said, look, we think with moderate confidence that part of it is right. It's more the impact thing, like, you know, was data exfiltrated? How far did it get? What do you know there? Like, how can you just say, oh yeah, this was successful? You know, without providing. And, you know, one thing is, man, Nicole Perlroth, who's one of the reporters who worked on this piece, quite often when people question her on this stuff, she sort of plays it off like it's people being, oh, it's technical people being pedantic. But providing some sort of evidence to actually back up the central claims in your reporting, that's not pedantry. You know, like that's pretty important to actually back up the central claims in your story. That is not just technical people not understanding how journalism works. This is, you know, it's just bad reporting. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, there isn't any strong evidence or any evidence presented by the private sector company that is the sort of the backing source for this, called Area One, that they have some way of determining that these campaigns were successful. And indeed, how many other campaigns are going on, you know, by the same actors, whether it's a case of kind of, you know, selection bias, where you're looking for attacks against that fit this narrative, when in fact actually the GRU is owning all sorts of things in Ukraine, as you would well expect that they are. But yeah, I mean, the good point about whether or not they have any telemetry that suggests, you know, people were successfully phished, that they were logging into these fake sites, that those credentials were subsequently harvested and used to log into the real things, and then whether or not there was any onwards access gained. And, you know, in some cases it's possible to figure that stuff out. If you've got enough visibility of what the attackers are doing, if you've compromised some of their C2 or staging posts, or you can see other telltales in, you know, in DNS logs or in caches or in, you know, there's some way of telling that, then yeah, you would have some evidence that you could share. And that's
sure. But if you're going to make the claim, at least, you know, tell us what's underpinning the claim. And that's my problem here. I'm not saying it's not true. I'm saying that the story doesn't do anything to substantiate the claim. And that's the problem. The other problem, of course, being that Area One Security, the company whose report this is based on, kind of has form at being a little bit sloppy with its claims.
Yeah, there is some analysis of some of their previous attributions, you know, which did kind of fit the same sort of thing. And I don't know a whole bunch about the company. They do seem to do, you know, kind of private sector, you know, intel, threat intel sorts of things. And yeah, they haven't been super forthcoming in the public eye to really kind of back up their claims and substantiate them. Well, I mean, they make the point that they, you know, they work for their customers who pay their bills and give them the data, which, you know, okay, fair enough, I can get that. But when it kind of ends up in, you know, the public discourse like this, and I mean, you know, these reports have been, you know, immediately taken at headline face value, and then everyone is kind of, well, there's certainly a bunch of people going onwards like it was set in stone, right? like this is just what happened, and moving onwards in there with the assumption that it's correct. And you know, when they're messed up in that, this, you would kind of like to see a bit more forthcomingness about what their, you know, their techniques are and what their, you know, what their reasons are for doing this attribution, and it being, you know, a bit more concrete.
Okay, turning our attention to one of the other big news themes of the last couple of weeks is Iran. Now, I've spoken to a bunch of people about Iranian activity over the last couple of weeks, and there has been an uptick, apparently. There has been a bit of an uptick, but it's unclear if it's actually related to the recent developments in, you know, Iran and Iraq and whatnot, right? So one thing that's been happening, I had a good chat with Ryan Callenber at Proofpoint, and he says that there has been a pivot to a new target set, which includes things like life sciences and, you know, a subset of that is, of course, pharmaceuticals. And the Iranian pharmaceutical market is a mess at the right now because of sanctions and whatever. But that pivot started around December, right? And then they've just sort of moved to the next phase of that campaign. So there's been a bit of an uptick. It's kind of hard to know, you know, how much of this is just business as usual and upticks being a coincidence versus Iran really going feral after, you know, one of its generals was assassinated by the United States. So I'm not seeing anything concrete that says Iran has just gone off the chain based off recent developments.
Yeah, and I mean, you would expect that the Iranians were already doing a bunch of this stuff already. And, you know, it kind of messes up cause and effect, right? I mean, it may well be that they are going out and doing hacking specifically as a result of this. It may also be that because tensions have ratcheted up, a bunch of other operations that, you know, previously weren't necessarily greenlit or too risky or whatever kind of get approval. And they're just other campaigns that, you know, would have happened anyway, or would have happened at a different pace, or, you know, in a less visible way.
I think the thing that I keep visualizing is like that episode of The Simpsons where Homer goes to work for Scorpio and he becomes a boss, and he goes in and he sees his workforce and they're all typing away on their computers. He said, "Hey guys, are you working hard?" And they said, "Yes, boss." And he said, "Do you think you can work a little bit harder?" And they said, "Sure." And they just start typing a bit faster. That's what I'm seeing.
Yeah, you know, exactly,
like, right? That's the vibe at the moment. But as you say, right, like, this means that people who maybe previously weren't being listened to might get more attention now. Like, this is, you imagine that these are the sort of circumstances under which, you know, the Iranian military might start thinking a little bit more creatively, right? And that the fallout from all of this stuff might take a little while to materialize.
Yeah, and I mean, you would think, like, if Iran really wanted to do, you know, to do cyber, to do impact as a result of this, if they had chosen to do so, right, it's not like this is a surprise, right? I mean, tensions have been ratcheting up for ages, right? They've had loads of time to, you know, prepare the battle space, like the Americans say. And, you know, they've already got a bunch of stuff, I imagine, in place that they need, you know, the access that they need to actually go and do stuff. And clearly, if they were going to roll, then, you know, they would use that rather than starting from scratch. Like, you don't go and hack the thing on day one, but you hack the thing on, you know, day minus 20 so that you're ready to roll. So yeah, you would expect them to have had all of that stuff ready, you know, for when they really decide to kick it off. And then, you know, maybe they're a little wary about starting to kick it off, you know?
Yeah, we've also had a report out of Saudi Arabia pertaining to a wiper attack on a Bahrainian company called Babco. And it's a new type of wiper. I think we will probably see more sort of destructive wiper style attacks against oil interests, right? Because that sort of hits their goals nicely. If they can do anything to disrupt energy supply, that's going to be good for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of following a pattern where we, you know, we saw against Saudi Aramco and a bunch of other, you know, energy operations in the region. And I mean, yeah, the fact that there's a new piece of malware during the rounds. The thing that was interesting about this particular wiper was the telemetry data that people were, or the data that people were looking at when it was being used against Bahrain, was that it was being compiled pretty much in real time. Like, the whatever infrastructure they were using was building the malware tooling on the fly so that then they could go and deploy it, which was a thing I think was novel, that people were calling out as novel about it, versus, you know, kind of compiled a couple of years previously, which may just, you know, kind of suggest new tooling or new approaches or something.
Now we're going to turn our attention to American shadow brokers, Intrusion Truth, basically. Yeah. Well, that's a bit of maybe not the best comparison, but Intrusion Truth is a blog, a group of people, or an individual, I guess, who tends to write a lot about Chinese APT activities, like doxing various people. They got another post up, and it's a fun read.
Yeah, this one looks into operations in Hainan, the island of Hainan in China, and looks at a bunch of technology companies that have been, you know, kind of recruiting and operating there, and starts, it feels like it's going to be a series of posts looking at, you know, the Chinese government-sponsored attackers, you know, operating out of that particular region, and looking at the way that they're, you know, fronting it with private sector companies. And the post pulls together, you know, a bunch of job ads with very similar wording and a bunch of, like, shared shared contact information for a whole bunch of very generic sounding, similar, you know, pen test firms that are actually looking for skills that look a little bit more like offensive, you know, less red teamy, more, you know, actual operations sort of skills. So yeah, kind of pulls together what promises to be the beginning of an interesting series of blog posts, perhaps.
That's going to identify a bunch of front companies belonging to APT 40. So yeah, stay tuned. That one looks cool. Now, look, we got an interesting piece here from Wired, from Lily Hay Newman, about the whole TOTOC thing. The reason I want to, I mean, we did speak about that a bit with Alex last week, but what I find interesting about this story is that it's sort of discussing the dilemma Apple finds itself in with regard to whether or not to allow TOTOC back into its app store. Google has allowed it. You know, Apple hasn't, as far as I know, yet. And look, it's good food for thought. I mean, if you have a suspicion that a communications app is being used, you know, that a government is getting unfettered access to people's communications via an app sold through your store or deployed through your store, do you pull it? You know, I mean, the limits of what for allow and disallow into a store like that, I mean, they can't just be a static line, can they? They're going to change. And I guess this piece kind of looks at that issue.
Yeah, I mean, it really does illustrate the challenges when you've got what is plausibly kind of lawfully operated, you know, kind of government interception or government monitoring. Where it's kind of covert, and I think that's where the initial you know, kind of furor against TOTOC kind of came out, was that it wasn't clear that that was what was going on. At least when you use the PSTN, you know, or the cell network, the cell phone network, right, you know that your government and anyone, other governments that your phone call traverses, you know, have some right to do lawful intercept, they have the capability, blah, 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 blah. When it's not clear that that's the case, then, you know, we ended up in the situation here. But, you know, when it's now out and we understand what's going on and people who making, you know, who are using the app are making an informed choice, I don't know if that's the right approach to head down. But, you know, it's not like, you know, Google could flag the app in the App Store and say, hey, if you download this app, then you'll be intercepted by, you know, the UAE and the Saudis and the Bahrainis and the, you know, Omanis and whoever else is involved.
When you're talking about regimes that don't have excellent human rights records. I mean, you know, as much as a phone call between you and I from Australia to New Zealand, the government may listen to it, they actually need to have a reason and go to the courts and apply for interception warrants and demonstrate exhaustion and things like that. Whereas you get the sense that, you know, in a lot of these countries we're talking about, it's just like, there's the message database, have at it, right? Which is a completely different thing. And I'm not sure that that's entirely, you know, I don't think that that falls into the basket of legal intercept per se, you know?
No, but then again, we have to get to the point where, you know, different countries do have different standards and different ways of operating, and, you know,
and that's the crux of the argument, right?
Exactly,
like, should Apple play that game, right? And if they're going to not allow TOTOC, why do they allow WeChat? You know, where do you find that line? It gets complicated.
It is, and I'm not envious of the people at Apple that have to, you know, make that decision, are having that meeting this week, because yeah, it is. It's a really complicated, thorny issue because it starts to get right into, you know, sovereign geopolitics. And, you know, when you're just trying to run an app store, that's perhaps complexity that you're not really, I mean, I suppose Apple's equipped to deal with it. But, you know, if you're a smaller company, then it's really just not clear what you're supposed to do. I mean, it's not even clear what you're supposed to do when you're a big company, I guess. I mean, what do we expect as customers, you know?
I'm sure there's robust discussion internally on that one, you know, and a few other things, right? What have we got here? Another one from ZDNet, from Catalan, of course. US troops deploying to the Middle East have been told to leave their personal electronics at home, which is, I mean, you know, that's a good thing, really. When you're talking about force security, that's got to be a good thing. When it comes to morale, though, not necessarily such a good thing. What do you think of this?
I mean, yeah, clearly from an OPSEC point of view, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, getting everybody to do things right on all of their range of personal devices clearly was never going to happen. Just telling the military, you know, giving them some orders to do a particular thing, even though it's uncomfortable for them, you know, military understands that. My concern, of course, is that, you know, the soldiers who are taking devices out in the field, they're doing so for a reason. They want to talk to their family. They want to read the news. They want to watch sports. They want to do all of these things. That's not going to change, right? And they're just going to find other ways to do it. I mean, there's nothing, you know, a board jar head is a very, very creative thing. And they will find ways. Like, they'll just go and buy an Android phone from, you know, a market somewhere, and it will be just as bad, if not worse, than the one they were going to take with them. So, you know, there's a full set of problems, and they're solving the beginning of it, but now they've caused a whole bunch of other downstream problems, and they're going to have to figure that out too.
Yeah, I mean, if you can bring vodka in resealed pineapple tins into a war zone, you can probably find a way to get a device in as well, right?
So. Exactly, right.
may or may not have some fun stories from friends about that. Moving on, Amnesty's suit against NSO Group is continuing. It is urging an Israeli court to restrict the business of NSO Group and, you know, cancel its export license, according to this piece on Cyberscoop from Jeff Stone.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds. I can't imagine the Israeli courts are going to be super sympathetic to it. But hey, I mean, we will see, I guess, whether or not there is, you know, still sympathy.
TravelX still mopping up, apparently, which is, geez, you know, this one's, yeah, like that's a lot of mopping.
It's a lot of mopping. Although, you know, I did quite like MalwareTech's take on it, which is, you know, you've owned a company that does hundreds of billions of dollars a year in transactions and you stick them for $3 million worth of ransomware. Like, come on. Like, is financial crime really that hard?
Well, it kind of is, right? Like, getting money out of the system, that's the hard part, right? Whereas if you can just get your Bitcoin into a Bitcoin exchange, throw it through a few tumblers and then hope you don't get, you know, vanned when you actually try to turn that into cash wherever you are, then, hey, you know.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. It just seems like a failure of imagination. You could have done so much better with, you know, with owning that place up. But, yeah, they got a whole bunch of mopping to do. You know, it's such a big operation. And, they're clearly having a pretty rough time of it.
The funny thing I've noticed about this one is people sort of saying, good, their rates are criminal. God, you know, converting money at TravelX, good way to get stung. So I think a few people are kind of oddly enjoying seeing them suffer. But I don't think this is going to do much to improve those spreads, funnily enough. They might need to increase them a bit to pay for all of this. Boing Boing got itself owned. Apparently, whoever did it managed to bypass 2FA as well. So it was probably like an OTP, you know, pass through or something.
Yeah. We don't know exactly what OTP mechanism it was, but yeah, someone managed to get hold of credentials, bypass OTP, log into their publishing system, and then like alter the site template to send people off to some, you know, kind of WeHackStu malware site or something, which, yeah, I mean, pretty funny, I guess.
Kuwait's state news agency suffered a similar fate. It had its Twitter account popped and it sent a tweet saying that US forces were due to pull out of Kuwait. And then they, you know, wrestled control back of their account and said that's absolutely not the case. But we can expect to see more and more and more and more of this sort of thing.
Yeah, and you would hope that news agencies are at least rolling two-factor on some of their accounts, but it's, you know, it's difficult when you have to share access between a bunch of publishers and all that kind of thing, right? I mean, it is difficult to do well, but, you know, I don't know how many times you want to get your state news agency owned. I can't imagine the government was particularly happy with them about that.
No, probably not. Joe Cox for Motherboard has a great story about how SIM swappers have, they've cut out the middleman. They were bribing people at telcos to do their SIM swap fraud, but now they're just dropping RDP onto various boxes inside telcos and doing it themselves. And not just inside telcos, but inside certain stores as well. So I don't know if they're doing it with physical access to certain machines. A lot of it seems to revolve around socially engineering people into either turning RDP on or installing it. But, you know, not surprised here. Like, SIM swapping is just, like, so pervasive now.
Yeah, it is. And it's kind of, you know, novel seeing them discover all of these new techniques and ways that are, you know, easier than what they were doing before to be able to achieve it. And, you know, the idea that they're sitting around, you know, with, you know, VNC or whatever other remote access tool installed on some telco desktop and are having to like pointy-clicky navigate through the terrible back-end telco user interface tools to be able to do the SIM swapping. It's like, oh, I'm blessed. Like, you're inside the telco. Surely you can find a better, more effective way to do this. Like, there's a lot. You don't have to use the pointy-click interface. Like, you could write some Corba, you know, make some calls to the back end. You could automate this thing.
You build
some
middleware. You expect too much, Adam. You expect too much. Come on.
I've just hacked a lot of telcos, and I don't want to sit through their nasty pointy-clicky interface. It's just not how you get stuff done there.
Princeton University, meanwhile, has done an academic study, pretty groundbreaking stuff, that says that five major US prepaid wireless carriers are vulnerable to SIM swapping attacks. I just love it when you see academic studies like this, which is, okay, sure, you needed to do your study into something, right? But like, you kind of proved something obvious there, Gay.
Well, yeah, and also, like, how did this go past their ethics board? Like, yeah, we're going to rig up the call center at Verizon or whoever and lie to them about our pins and lie to them about, you know, try and SIM swap them. Like, come on, really? Like, that's an academic study. Like, that's really... I don't know.
Well, look, 2FA is moving on. And in this next piece, we see that you can now use your iPhone as a 2FA token for your Gmail through Bluetooth to your desktop, which is, you know, this is another novel approach.
Yeah, I mean, this is Google's got an app that runs on the phone. They've had a similar sort of thing for Android that uses the, you know, the hardware identifier and the secure enclave on the phone to kind of function like a U2F token so that you can do authentication from the phone, which, you know, is convenient. It's one less device to carry around. It's kind of a more complicated device than a, you know, than a YubiKey or one of the, you know, the Titan keys that Google's been pushing. But yeah, anything that improves adoption, lowers the barrier to people is absolutely great.
Well, it's one less thing to carry as well, right? Which I think is the real thing. Oh, by the way, I made a bit of a... Well, I don't know if it was a mistake last week, but I was speaking about how I was pretty sure I got WebAuthn via Safari when I was setting up a new phone. You know what it's like when you're setting up a new phone? There's creds flying around, there's apps being installed, it's all that sort of thing. Safari definitely Face ID'd me, but I don't think it was WebAuthn on reflection, right? Because someone pointed out on Twitter, they're like, I don't think it supports that yet via the Secure Enclave. So I think it might have been like Face ID to autofill something, and I normally never autofill anything, and maybe that's something that happened then. So yeah, sorry if I got that wrong, but we do know it's a matter of time before you can WebAuthn via Secure Enclave Face ID to Safari. That'll be pretty rad.
Yeah, I mean, anything that makes auth, you know, less passwordy and more reliable and easier for everybody, it's gonna improve everything.
It's just so sci-fi, you know, log into your bank with a face scan, you know, it's awesome. I'm gonna
steal your face.
Google is doing some interesting stuff to Chrome. They're going to drop support for tracking cookies by 2022. And I also saw some news that they're dropping user agent strings.
Yeah, they do seem pretty keen to get rid of user agents. And let's face it, user agents have been garbage forever. You know, everybody has to say that they're, Mozilla or something. And then, you know, a whole bunch of brackets. And then you get to say what you actually are. So, yeah, getting rid of them doesn't seem like a terrible idea. The cookie situation, I'm not 100% sure what's going on here. Like, there's been some mechanism for restricting the scope of cookies between sites, and they're proposing to change the way that Chrome handles that. And they've come up with a bunch of mechanisms to try and allow their advertising to work the same. And I'm a little bit vague about how that all fits together, but the sort of people who would normally whinge about this aren't whinging. So from that, I assume they must be getting it more right than usual.
Detailed analysis from Adam Bailoro there, who obviously cares very, very deeply about privacy issues that don't involve shells. That's right up your alley, apparently. Very quickly, we got a piece here from Cyberscoop where this congressional commission, the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, you know, is funny, man, because they're talking about issuing a directive to the private sector called the 1-10-60 rule. This is their benchmark for the private sector, which encourages firms to detect intrusions in 1 minute, have an analyst evaluate it in 10 minutes, and remediate it within 60 minutes. Thanks, government. That's great advice. We'll get right on that. The thing that blows my mind about this is the current dwell time, like the time to detect someone on your network currently, is around an average of 2 years. So the 1 minute part of the 1-10-60 rule kind of had me chuckling. How about you?
It's like a nice idea, and it would be
it's
a
like
good thing.
To stop all of this cyberspace drama, it's like the government saying, just stop the hackers. Just detect and remediate their things. Problem solved.
Just stop them hacking you. And when they do detect it, yeah, that'd be fine. Yeah. And then throw them out. But no, I mean, it's... I mean, I looked at it and went, okay, let's take it on face value and say that they are going to detect me in a minute, look at it in 10 minutes, and then throw me out in 60. I've got an hour. Like, that's plenty. Like, yeah, and? You know, I mean, I get to hang around for a whole hour. I can get a lot done.
Yeah, 2 years average, right? So... An hour is pretty much like light speed. Something that I didn't cover off last week that I should have, Apple has lodged another claim against Corellium, this time for DMCA stuff, saying that because they allow people to, like, you know, their stuff helps people create jailbreaks, they're creating a circumvention device, they've just gone full hardcore against Corellium, and it's really weird.
Yeah, what are you doing, Apple? Like, what are you doing? Yeah. Maybe someone's just got, you know, a little bit chompy and bit between their teeth in the legal department. What are you doing?
I mean, your reading of this makes them come off like idiots as well, or like...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It just seems heavy-handed for what is really such a very, very, very small thorn in their side. Like, is it really worth this much grief, you know, for, you know, a husband and wife operation that's, you know, building useful tools, but really on the scale of things that are going wrong in their ecosystem? Like, it seems pretty small chips to focus on.
I think it really does. I think that initial narrative, which I was skeptical of, does seem correct, which is that they just want to shut down and restrict any sort of security research that doesn't wind up getting reported to them. You know, and I can understand how there would be some altruistic motives there from their side. They're saying, well, if we can completely shut down the Vuln Discovery ecosystem, then exploits won't wind up in the hands of the baddies, right? But they're shutting down a lot of other stuff as well.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there's certainly a lot of people doing a lot of really valuable research that does, you know, even if in a roundabout way, you know, even if it takes a while to get there, like it gets used for other things on the way, it does in the end improve the platform. So,
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think we're both on the same page with that one. Yeah. We got a final figure for the Equifax settlement. It has agreed to pay $380.5 million to resolve allegations related to the 2017 data breach. Another one from Jeff Stone at Cyberscoop here.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like a whole bunch of money given how many people had their stuff nicked. And yeah, there is a process to go through to get some of this money. And it just all seems like, I don't know, I mean, I feel like Equifax could have done with yet more spanking, but I suppose $380 million is still something.
It's more dollars than I have.
It's exactly more dollars than I got through.
Look, that's pretty much it for the week's news. We didn't talk about Donald Trump tweeting about iPhones, iPhone unlocks. That's pretty 2020. But he said, what is it? We are helping Apple all of the time on trade and so many other issues, and yet they refuse to unlock phones used by killers, drug dealers, and other violent criminal elements. They will have to step up to the plate and help our great country now make America great again. So, you know, we got the president of the United States tweeting about phone unlocks, but this is interesting, right? Because, you know, last year, I think it was, we spoke about Lindsey Graham, you know, giving tech companies an earful, saying you've got to fix this or we're going to be back here in a year and you're going to have a bad time. Now we've got the US president going at it. So this is absolutely on the agenda for this year, I think. Doubt we'll see any legislation through this year, though, given everything else that's going to happen. But, you know, in a second term Trump government, I think it could be interesting, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is, the pressure is going to ratchet back up on the tech industry, and you know, they need to come up with something that's going to placate them because Lindsey Graham was more forceful. I mean, in a way, more inclined to listen to him than Trump, you know, kind of venting. But yeah, I don't know if I was Google or Apple or Facebook, you know, you'd be sitting around trying to come up with something that's just gonna I don't know what they're gonna do, but. I guess that's why I don't work there.
Yeah, that's right. And we've also got a couple of items for this week's reading list. Alex Stamos did the winter 2019 commencement speech for the University of California, Berkeley School of Information, and it's actually a pretty good speech. So I threw that into the show notes. And then we've got a piece from the Insurance Journal that was published on December 3 last year, and I just saw it floating by recently. I think it was on Twitter, which is really looking at this whole idea of whether or not NotPetya was like an act of war. And, you know, there's a $1.3 billion claim relating to Merck and its losses there. So it's just an interesting read, all in the show notes. But Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining us, my friend. And we'll chat to you again next week. It's great to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Good to have some good bugs to talk about as well. Some nice remotes. Good. But yes, maybe we'll have some more next week. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. And yeah, sorry, I forgot to mention, the show is a day late this week. You haven't had a stroke. It is a day late, and it's just because Adam and I both had a couple of things on this week, and we could have struggled to get it out at the usual time, and we just thought, nah, let's do it a day late because then we're not going to be rushed and you'll get a better result. So there you go. A few shout outs now. Andrew Wally, Kevin Credit, Stephen Reese Carter on behalf of WordFence, Stephen Seely, and a couple of others who don't want to be named. All of those people are listeners who have donated or raised money for the bushfire crisis here in Australia. Massive thanks to all of you. And a quick update on the fire situation. It looks like the next week, even the next few days, is going to be wet, wet, wet here in Australia. So there is a chance that a lot of these fires could be extinguished, which would be great. So fingers crossed. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Extra Hop Network's VP of Cybersecurity Engineering, Matt Cawthorn. Extra Hop does, you know, machine learning based network detection stuff, you know, intrusion detection stuff, a la Vectra or Darktrace, I guess. But to be honest, what appeals to me about their stuff is, you know, it's broader than that. It has security adjacent use cases around general network and infrastructure monitoring. And, you know, they do inventory stuff as well. So they're going less for, we stop all the cyber threats with magic AI pixie dust, and more, you know, we ingest absolutely everything and draw insights from it. They go up to layer 7 if you let them. They can monitor sort of transaction health and latency, and, you know, they do all sorts of cool stuff. And now they're pushing pretty hard into cloud. Now the cloud providers offer customers the ability to take virtual network taps out of their environments, right? And I still find it amazing that this is a recent development. I mean, this happened as best I can remember. This is like a last year thing. This is a 2019 thing. And I think, you know, for a long time, the major cloud infrastructure providers just thought, hey, you know, we'll give everyone logs and that's how they monitor their stuff. And, you know, there are obviously organizations using that approach, but as you'll hear, network traffic is a great place. It's a great data source to get what our next source calls ground truth. Matt Cawthorn joined me for this chat, and I asked him if he agrees that network traffic monitoring can best be described in the year 2020 AD as stubbornly useful. And here's what he had to say.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And stubbornly useful because it really does represent, it's as close to the ultimate ground truth as you can get.
Yeah, and I've heard others say that, incidentally. That seems to be the catch cry of people who work in the network-based space.
Yeah, I mean, this comes by our CTO, Jesse Rothstein, says that, and I say it too. I firmly believe it. You know, logs can be evaded. They can be disabled. They can, in fact, be, you know, there's many different ways to evade logging and covering your tracks. And the same can be said of agents. And it's not that those things are bad. Like, an endpoint agent is good. Everyone should be using them. And logs are awesome. Back in my operational days, we used logs as well. But the thing that can't be disabled is the passive network monitor, the passive thing that watches the connected tissue and understands the actors on the wire and the transactions that they're exchanging. And so the network, I believe, will really always be relevant in that way, because if you think of the holy trinity, as it were, of endpoint, logs, and wire, just from a data source perspective, those three things constitute the richest sources of data for the SOC anywhere.
Now, your big thing is, just look, based on your marketing that I've read, I mean, it seems like big environments are kind of your specialty. Is that about right?
A big environment. So we thrive in big environments. Our scalability from just as a product company, our scalability is very, very good relative to the other players in our space. But that's extended into cloud as well. You know, so now
this is kind of where I was going with that, is like now you've got, you know, you've got an ability to really broaden out, apply your stuff elsewhere into all of these new environments. And I'm just wondering, like, how do you do that when you're dealing with such a massive environment? Because all of a sudden, you know, we're talking essentially about virtual network taps, but, you know, there's going to be people who are going to want to use an awful lot of those taps and sort of have an awful lot of data. You know, you're going to be dealing with a lot of ingest. How do you even start to look at dealing with that?
So, without going into too much of the weeds, the way we do it is we don't solve that problem in the traditional way, which was writing packets to disk and then retroactively asking questions of those packets, indexing them and pulling them back off of disk, which there's just too much in the modern era. There's too much volume and too much latency for that approach. We can store packets, many people can, but there's just latency involved in that, generally speaking. And so from the network's perspective as a data source, if you treat it as a first-class data source, you know, time to insight matters. And those things can be done in the modern era in real time. And so we actually do stateful stream reassembly across millions of current connections. If they're encrypted, we can decrypt them and get at the layer 7 transactions themselves, which really ultimately represent the behaviors. That's where the ground truth comes in. It's not enough to know who's talking to who, how much data was transferred. Those are useful metrics for sure. But understanding the transactions that actually traverse a socket, the disposition of those transactions and how those things differ over time, as well as all of the auto discovery and classification of assets, all of these things combine into a very powerful detection and investigation framework.
Sure. I guess I was like looking even a little bit, you know, lower level than that, is like, how are you even transporting this data around? I mean, do you have like cloud-based collection agents that sort of sit in someone's AWS environment? I mean, are you pointing, you know, are they doing some sort of metadata stripping and sending that off for ingest to your stuff and then writing the rest to disk? Like, how do you even architect all of a sudden when you're going to be taking all of this network data from a cloud environment, right, out of these virtual taps? How do you even architect that when you're dealing with an environment that's beyond a few EC2 instances?
That's right. So that's a good question. Thank you for the clarification. So there's a few different approaches. One is we actually have a SaaS offering where they can mirror their traffic into our a private carved out VPC that we stand up just for the customer, where we manage the kit and the ingest and the sort of scale out, the horizontal scale out to accommodate these larger environments. So that's one option. And other customers prefer to run local in VPC. So we have instances that are capable of up to 25 gigs of analysis per second in the cloud from the vSwitches in the cloud, or the virtual taps rather, in the cloud. And we're able to run right next to their assets in an availability zone. And so, and there are variations. Well,
and then how do you fuse that with their, you know, their traditional like enterprise network stuff? I mean, are people using, you know, the extra hop stuff to do both, or are they using two different instances, one for the sort of enterprise side and one for the production environment? You know, like what's the typical use there? Like, is there much benefit to fusing those two things together?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, to answer your first question, the way we would typically deploy, when let's consider an enterprise data center and they are doing, they're in the throes of a migration to cloud, which seems to be ubiquitous here in the States, at least. And then we've got an enterprise, we've got a cloud presence and sort of running in parallel, whether it's the same set of applications or not, and they're trying to understand the differences, the delta from a performance perspective, from a security perspective. We can federate those views. And we can show you what the protocols are involved, which assets are serving them. For example, the database read to write ratio, what the nature of those database transactions are from the enterprise all the way into cloud, and give you these comparisons. And so one of our strengths, and I don't want to turn this into a product pitch, but you know, we're very good at discovery and classification of not only the assets, the participants of conversations, but what services that they expose and who are consuming those services all the way down to layer 7 transactions.
Well, to be honest, Matt, and sorry to cut you off there, but like it's the security adjacent use cases that actually seem like they're probably the selling point for a lot of companies who buy your stuff, right? Stuff like you were just talking about there.
If you think, you know, writ large, network analytics should be able to accomplish many things.
Yeah.
So if you're a proper analytic, if you have proper analytics, you should be able to inform decisions about how to optimize a database farm for a middleware tier. And you should understand those things. You should also understand your risk surface there. You should understand the attacks that are coming in. But all of these things are an artifact of just first-class network analytics. And as a data source, the network really kind of wins, we would argue. It's one of the best data sources available to operations. And so you can and should be able to accommodate network-centric use cases, performance-centric, capacity planning, and we really emphasize the security side. But all of it is fair game, totally.
I think one thing that makes this cloud-based network tapping stuff really interesting is, you know, when you're trying to do network analysis and make it useful for an enterprise, you kind of want to be doing your east-west as well as your north-south, whereas, you know, now when you've got, like, say, a complicated cloud environment, you can just all of a sudden apply virtual network taps wherever you want. I mean, that problem is not, because, you know, doing east-west in an enterprise network can be quite difficult. But now with these virtual taps in a cloud environment, it's really easy, isn't it? It's going to be easy to get visibility on absolutely everything. Are people going a little bit overboard, though? Because I can imagine that you would have some customers who are just, like, basically putting a tap on every single virtual interface they have.
Yeah, and so that is a choice that they could go. That's a road that they could go down. And certain customers, especially on the larger end of the spectrum, are grappling with some of the design decisions and the implications of that approach, which it's totally possible. In fact, you can automate all of these things now based on the events that propagate through a cloud environment, which is a very interesting thing, you know. But I'm glad you mentioned, Patrick, the east-west corridor, because you're exactly right. Historically, East-West has been a very difficult challenge from an analytics, a network analytics perspective. The industry is focused on North-South for, you know, several decades now. And East-West capability is really at the epicenter of these, well, that's where dwell time lives, frankly.
Yeah.
From an attack perspective. And
well, it's where lateral movement pops up.
You've got it. That's right. And so this is where the sophisticated attacker will reside, whether it's a fast and destructive attack or low and slow, and it doesn't matter. They're going to land very commonly in the east-west corridor. And that analytical problem has been a big challenge, which is one of the reasons why we emphasize that. And in the cloud, you're right, it's all kind of fair game, as it is in the enterprise too. But you have to, there's a lot more plumbing involved in the enterprise. Deployments are non-trivial.
Yeah. Yeah. But I guess what I'm getting at is like when it comes to the cloud environments, like you can just see it all.
Yes,
and it's easy,
absolutely.
Right? Like it's just completely easy. Look, Matt, that was a really interesting chat. Matt Cawthorn, thank you very much for joining us on the show. Welcome as a sponsor. It's great to have you on board, and we'll be chatting to you again, I'm sure. Thanks again.
Looking forward to it. Thanks so much.
That was Matt Cawthorn from ExtraHop Networks there. Big thanks to him for that. And big thanks to ExtraHop Networks for coming on board as a 2020 sponsor. You can check him out at extrahop.com. And as I say, I think this stuff is pretty interesting because it's not just about doing network IDS, you know, with some AI or ML. Like it does other stuff too. And, you know, if you're monitoring like two cloud deployments and, you know, your transaction times for one of them starts going up, like that can be the sign of problems. Like it just seems like the sort of stuff that I think, you know, and I'm not a user, I don't know users, but it just seems like they seem like their stuff is worth looking at. So that's that. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.